Hey, Jamie, I've got a question for you.
What do you want, Tom?
Who's on the podcast this coming Friday? Is it someone big?
Boy.
Is it a big one? Shall I bother listening this week?
Yeah. If I was going to say take.
And I would say off.
No.
Your trousers.
No, no. Take.
Me out.
No. Take.
Paddy McGuinness.
No. Take.
Take on me.
Take that.
Wow.
Have a little patience.
But hang on, presumably you haven't got all three of them, have you? Presumably you've just got one of them.
Buddy, we have all three of them on the podcast. They've released a new album. It's coming out. They're going on tour. They talk about the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, on everything that happened in Take That.
The ins, the outs.
And they reveal it all this Friday.
Exclusively.
On Private Parts.
That's a big one. I'm going to listen to that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, welcome to Whole Truth Podcast. I'm here with Owen O'Kane.
Yeah.
You are author of new book, 10 to Zen. 10 minutes a day to a calmer, happier you.
Yeah.
You're an NHS mental health expert. So, I think just from that introduction, coming on a podcast as discussing mental health.
yeah.
You're pretty well qualified, I'd say.
No pressure, NHS mental health expert.
Yeah. I think the book is fantastic. I think just through my own personal experience, I've been doing a lot of therapy.
Yeah.
And then I've also been reading a lot of books. And, you know, a lot of these chapters are jumping out to me in some of the way it's talking about separating guilt and shame and a calm space, and it seems very digestible and a genuine.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that was the general idea, actually. I wanted it to be really practical.
Yeah.
And user-friendly, because I think when it comes to mental health and therapy and stuff, I just think there's so much stuff out there.
Yeah,
loads
there
of stuff, and people get really confused. And when I decided to write the book, what I wanted to do was kind of give people something that they could use practically every day. 10 minutes is nothing, really. Somebody was talking earlier about meditating for an hour every day, and most people struggle with that.
Yeah.
You know, getting an hour into a day, whereas I think 10 minutes people can do.
Totally.
Which was kind of the idea behind the book. And I didn't want it to be too fluffy. I didn't want it to be over academic. I just wanted it to be, regardless of who you are, you'd pick it up and there'd be hopefully something in there that would resonate and help.
10 minutes. I mean, I have someone who I've been diagnosed with ADHD twice. I don't know if I believe necessarily in labels like that or whatever.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to find out what you think about that. But concentration and routine is something that I did genuinely struggle with.
Mm.
But 10 minutes does seem achievable to me. To find, well, 10 minutes.
Yeah, it does work. I mean, I use it every day, and if I don't use it every day, the quality of my day differs considerably.
Amazing.
In fact, the other day I didn't. I was rushing out. I was crazy the other day. My dog's poorly at the minute, and I was running around doing stuff. And I didn't do it, and I really noticed a difference.
Yeah.
Like a proper difference in my day. I was grumpy and just a bit more irritated, and stuff was really winding me up. I was driving around. I was conscious people kept cutting me out. And
yeah.
Normally I'm fairly chilled about stuff, but on the day I didn't use it, I really was bothered by stuff.
Totally. I get that. Yeah.
And I think that's part of the thing. Most of the time, our minds are just on autopilot, you know what I mean? It's just, there's a million thoughts going.
Have you done it today?
One time. Yeah, I did, yeah.
Feel good?
Morning. Yeah, I do, yeah.
We have a thing with a whole hour,
yeah.
Where we kind of encourage people to spend an hour of the day kind of out of the virtual reality that we live
out
in.
Of the world, yeah.
Yeah, and we kind of encourage stuff like, well, any kind of a physical activity or something just to check in with yourself, and even just picking the book up then, one of the first few chapters, it mentions checking in. Or you actually probably one of the first few pages.
It is, yeah. It's a kind of, well, it's the first step of the book, so the book's laid out really clearly, as you
yeah.
know, so it's kind of step by step, what do you do in the 10 minutes. And when I was kind of devising it, I think checking in sounds like a really stupid thing
no, I like
to encourage
it.
People to do, but you know, I meet you today and the first thing you say, how are you doing? And, you know, I ask you how you're doing. But often we go through the day and we haven't got a clue how we are.
Yeah.
And we're not checking in. We don't know what's going on.
I don't think we know how to even name necessarily what we're feeling.
Exactly.
We don't have the vocab for it.
I was doing an interview recently and there was a whole group of people doing the interview. And I said, well, has anybody checked in today? And nobody, well, I think one person had and the others hadn't. And so nobody really had any idea how they were feeling, what their mood was, whether they were anxious. And I think, well, if we don't know how we are, then it's really difficult to function effectively, because you do kind of need to know where you're at, really. Do you know what I mean? And I think, so I started off with that. Oh, it's a really good starting point, check in with yourself.
Really. Well, I think also that maybe even moves into the conversation surrounding the stigma we still have around, in inverted commas, negative emotions. Because I know that a few people I know, if they check in with themselves and they're not happy with what they find, that's probably more scary than just moving through life.
It's a good point, actually. I think a lot of people really struggle with it, because even that whole thing about the fact that we name them negative and positive emotions always really, really interests me, because they're human emotions.
And just
the minute we start calling them positive emotions, then we think they're the ones that we want. You know, I want to be happy, I want to be peaceful, I want to be excited. But then when the other stuff comes in, you know, anger, sadness, fear, we kind of almost try and push it away.
Yeah, and it's like that's like the worst thing you can do.
Of course it is, because the more you push something away, the more you push something down, the stronger it comes back.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people do that with inverted commas negative emotions. They try and get rid of them, or they try and beat them down in some way. Whereas I think, well, often with a negative emotion, there's a kind of underlying message of some description.
Yeah.
You know, if you're angry, probably not really that angry, really. You're probably sad about something, but if you don't really start exploring the emotions, you never know, really.
100%.
That's my take.
Why did you get into psychotherapy?
It's a good question.
Was there a moment?
There was, actually. There was I started off, so my background split. I started off, I trained to be a nurse originally, so half of my career was medical, worked with people who were terminally ill most of the time. And
what was the birth of that? That's a big...
I did it.
You're a hero, mate.
I know, it was a bizarre transition, because at the start of my career, I worked in accident and emergency, so it was kind of fast-paced, really quick.
But why? Mate, I'm trying to get to the...
Did I do it?
There's a load of people I know who are born, grow up, and not one point they go, I know what I want to do. I literally want to save people's lives. That's like an incredible calling.
I don't know. I grew up in Belfast, so... that was an interest, and I'll talk about that probably later. But I mean, that was an interesting place to grow up. And I grew up in the Troubles, so it was kind of all violent and bombs and stuff. And so I kind of got really curious about people and anxiety and all of that stuff. And when I look back, I remember thinking, will I be a therapist? And then I thought, that's probably a bit heavy. What will I end up doing? So bizarrely, I grew up an Irish Catholic, so I went off to train to be a priest for a couple of years and lived in a monastery, which sounds like the oddest thing in the world, but it was probably the most interesting 3 years of my life.
Like the outfit?
Yeah, well, they put you in some stuff.
I don't know how it works.
But you go off to uni and stuff and you do a degree and you do lots of training and different things. And 3 years in, I thought, you know, celibacy, you know, living in a monastery the rest of my life. You know, and I was young, I was like 19 when I joined, so I thought...
Is that celibacy real, for real, though?
Oh, yeah, it's proper.
What, no masturbation, nothing?
It's hardcore, you know, it's kind of...
Is it?
Yeah, well, it's the rule of the Catholic Church, so...
Well, you know, sometimes I worry that Dalai Lama's genuinely done that. And he's never ever pleasured himself, and that's why he's so happy. That's what I'm confused by. I think there's a point where you go, he's actually just not, because you get a bit stressed, innit, if you know what you're missing.
I tell you what, I suggest you get him in for the next podcast.
I'd love to get Dalai Lama in. How legendary that would be. No, I do actually. I understand the concept behind it. I think there is a sacredity to the sexual experience. Is that the right word? Sacred.
The sacredness.
Sacredity. I've made that up as well.
Don't know how we've got here. But anyway, but I suppose it's relevant.
You trained as a priest.
I started off. I didn't get ordained, but I did 3 years of it. And then when I left, it was pretty clear cut. I thought I wanted to work with people. I'd spent time in a hospice and I thought, I'm going to go and train to be a nurse. Did that, qualified, ended up doing A&E almost by accident, but I landed a job, did that, really fast paced, really good fun, enjoyed it. But then you burn out quite quickly. It's intense. You know, you're seeing a lot of really heavy stuff all the time. But then I thought, I kind of want to stay in an area, but I wasn't sure what area. And then I thought, I'm going to go into terminal care, so work with people who are terminally ill. And I did that for about 7-8 years.
Whoa.
And loved it, actually. I mean, it was the most, it sounds quite heavy, and but it wasn't at all, actually. It was probably the best part of my career. I really enjoyed it.
I find it quite intriguing, that acceptance or that understanding that life's to pass. You know, whenever I've briefly been involved in, I suppose, gender politics to an extent, and I'm kind of fascinated by specifically the male relationship with emotion because of the environment you're brought up in and whatever else. And one of the things I looked into was deathbed regrets.
Yeah.
Because I was just intrigued, you know, because sometimes you're encouraged to live a particular lifestyle or idea, and some of it is very material. Yeah. And so I looked up and it, you know, clarified what I thought. A lot of people were like, I wish I'd just slowed down a bit.
Well, it's one of the chapters in the book is talking about less, you know, I thought when I did this book, I thought, well, I can't leave out that part of my career.
Mm.
You know, all these lessons that you learn and all this kind of, you're with people every day as they're facing their mortality. And it was like every day you would come away with something new,
yeah,
or a new awareness, or, you know, what I thought was a problem in my life. Suddenly you go home and you think, actually, my problems are really quite small comparatively. But I think as well, it was just something about, you know, people when they're dying, not everyone, but a lot of people have a wisdom that we don't have, because suddenly everything's fast forwarded.
Yeah.
So they will make decisions and take more risk and worry less about stuff. And so in terms of doing that work, you were kind of helping people with pain management and all the usual stuff. But the one thing I didn't feel equipped to do was the psychological stuff. So I'd end up having really difficult conversations with people, and I would manage them. But I remember getting to the point where thinking, I don't feel skilled enough to manage the more complex conversations, and that then motivated me to go off and train to be a psychotherapist.
Were you aware of your own mental health when you began working in accident and emergency?
Not really. I mean,
when were you first aware that you, psychotherapy was something that also involved your own experience? You know?
Probably not until I started my own therapy.
Wow.
Because as a therapist, you've got to be in your own therapy. Yeah. It's kind of part of your journey, really. But so growing up in Northern Ireland was interesting because, you know, you normalise lots of stuff. So I thought I was pretty normal and stable and all of that stuff. Then, you know, you grow up, you leave home, you do all of that stuff. Yeah. Did my training. Then I did my therapy training. And I remember one of the first therapy sessions I did, I remember saying to this lady, I thought, oh, this is a bloody waste of time. I don't need therapy. And I remember saying to her, I'm not really sure I need to be doing this here, but I've got to do it. And I said, I think I'm pretty together. And she said, okay, why don't we talk about that in a few months and see how you feel about that.
Trust
then.
Me.
And that was really interesting.
Pandora's box,
isn't it? No, absolutely. And then suddenly you think, God, I think I've got it all together. And then suddenly realised, of course I didn't have it all together.
Trauma.
I grew up in Belfast, so of course, there you go. There's a recipe in itself. And also I had to come out as gay as well, which back then in Northern Ireland was a huge thing.
Massive thing.
Massive, massive thing to come out. And
there's almost a grief in that as well, because it's like, it's or a celebration of years of A kind of
repression.
It was a release.
So yeah, I started out my own therapy and then suddenly realised, yeah, I've got a bit of stuff to work on.
Wow.
Realised actually as well, I had never realised I was anxious until I started in therapy.
That's quite a thing because
you know, you can't not worry. I was talking to Rose earlier, who grew up in Northern Ireland. I don't think you can grow up in Northern Ireland and not be anxious, particularly if you grew up in the Troubles, because, of course, it was like,
it's a heightened state of awareness.
You were heightened the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, literally the whole
literally
time.
Wiring your nervous system.
So how can you not? Then you get into adulthood, and then suddenly you're in London, and a car backfires, and you jump out of your skin.
Whoa.
And then suddenly I realised, God, yeah, you're programmed to worry. And it would have been abnormal not to worry.
Yeah.
And I learned that about myself, and learned that, yeah, I do sometimes worry.
Beautiful that your kind of instinctive response was to help. I think you should.
I just kind of think, and I think when you do stuff like this, I mean, my take on it, when I first thought about doing a book, you have various conversations with people and publishers and stuff. And the one thing I refused to do and I wouldn't do was, I wasn't just going to write a book as a professional. Right. You know, and just kind of go with all the titles and stuff, because I thought, I've got to write it as a human being.
Uh-huh.
And be honest about my own stuff.
What are the titles? What letters are you missing off your name?
In terms of,
are you saying that you had
I have got a letter off
of
that.
What have you got?
All sorts of letters.
What are they?
But you know, I don't even talk about them.
Come on, man. This is like, this is a world of...
I've done a couple of degrees and stuff, and you know, you get letters for your psychotherapy training.
This is like, that's a real flossing match. That's
I don't, you know. It's funny, my parents, when I was growing up, used to talk about people and say, oh my God, he's really important. He's got letters after his name.
Damn right.
And it used to make me laugh, and suddenly you do get them back.
Owen O'Kane, CS5.
I don't know what they are. You know, what's a BSc and an MSc, and you get all these.
A BSc, MSc.
I want to put myself in the book. I wanted, you know, the professionals one part of it, and of course it has to be. I think sometimes when you're talking about mental health and well-being, of course you want your professional experience to be in it.
Yeah.
It's got to be important. But I think my experience as a therapist in the room with people, that the minute you, I'm not saying that you reveal everything about yourself, but I think the minute somebody in therapy knows that they're in the room with another human being, something magical happens, because then people start to open up and they start to talk and you start to make progress. Whereas I think if there's a kind of more robotic process where somebody, if I was doing therapy with you and you just thought it was just this practical, you know, guy with all of these...
Well, it's the beauty of therapy, you always have to be human.
You've got to be. And I think you have to be truthful about yourself as well. Yeah, you have to be honest. And I thought when I did this, I wanted to be truthful about what I struggle with.
That's great. Well, that's the real way to build connection, isn't it?
Well, I hope
through sharing vulnerabilities.
I hope so.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in that. That's why I think you can do like a 4, 5, 6 day retreat. And after those days, the people you're with feel like...
Yeah.
Family, because you've sat down and gone, I feel this, I feel that.
Well, even an interview like this, if you're not honest and you don't give real stuff, well then it's actually a waste of time.
I did this retreat called The Bridge. I just want to shout it out because it is genuinely a phenomenal experience. And yeah, like we did a lot of mixture of different therapeutic techniques, and it really confronts those aspects of you that you can hide behind. Those voices telling you don't really need to, you know. Like for me, I remember one of the things that was really difficult was accepting praise.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, I'm quite an exuberant person. Like a lot of people wouldn't question my confidence, but a lot of it I'd say is an overcompensation for like quite a deep fear I've had for a while socially. I kind of just go for it. I'm performative, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, yeah, I've always struggled. And it was only through doing that deep work with a group. And then I had to sit down. I mean, there's a lot of build up to this, but I had to sit down around, you know, like, essentially 12 people I didn't know. And they had to say nice things. And I had to just accept them.
Yeah,
and it was
tough.
the most difficult thing.
Yeah.
So knowing that you're in front of someone who you can consciously trust rather than unconsciously, it took me ages with my therapist to
kind of build that trust up.
Well, because it was like a lot of my issues around, well, I think with everyone, it's very, very parental, you know. And I think there were occasions where I would be unconsciously battling against a defense mechanism I'd established as a child. But I was coming between me and my therapist, and I spent a lot of time having to remind myself that
breaking
I'm
it down, I think it's similar as well when you do a book and stuff and people start reading the book, a similar thing happens, doesn't it? They have to find a connection with the writer, and they have to make a decision whether there's truth in this for them, and whether it resonates with them. And I think that's a real struggle when you're writing a book, because it's just you and your computer really, and you've got all this information in your head, but actually you are talking to people, and you're thinking of people you've worked with, and you're thinking of common struggles people have, and you're trying to get that out there in a way that people relate to.
Yeah,
and you're talking there about thinking as well. You know, lots of people do have these really negative thought patterns or negative view in themselves, either self-critical or self-judgmental or self-deprecating. And I see that every day of the week. And I think if you don't tackle that, then you're just kind of battling yourself the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of one of the things that I included about helping people to manage that part of them. Because often we buy into the stuff.
The intrusive thoughts.
Yeah, not even the intrusive, but the kind of automated thoughts. You know, the automated kind
especially of... Especially in London.
Yeah.
Almost being... maximizing yourself, I think it's I'm not sure if it's ever been celebrated as like a British.
Yeah.
Like one of the things that shocked me most when I went to America was how optimistic people were.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there's a in Britain, there's a it's almost like the offspring of there being a championing of humility. You know what I mean? I think at one point we actually really cherished the humility in a person. It was seen as a very respected value. Whereas now I think it's kind of like mutated into a space where people are not even acknowledging. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
No, I do.
When it's like playing it down, now people are just like not even giving themselves space to just be like, to enjoy the little wins they have. You know what I mean? You're allowed to go like, oh mate, I'd actually
I did well in that though. Well, that's classic in Irish culture actually. I mean, you don't celebrate very much. Well, you do, but you kind of don't. If something good happens and you're talking about it, that could be seen as bragging or showing off.
For real.
Well, certainly the culture I was brought up in, it was a bit like, you know, you kept things a bit private and you don't want to be a show off or seem to be getting too big for yourself or any of this kind of stuff. And I think you're right. I think American culture is different, whereas here we tend to,
which is also flawed, of course, in many respects. But I think that particularly was like quite a. I remember going in a studio, honestly, it was like a really massive opportunity, and this producer I adored for years and years was like, hey, yo, you guys are so, like, it was so, I made music for a long time with my mate Harley Rizzlekicks, and we got this massive opportunity, and I remember this guy was like, yo, I heard your music, man, you guys have got that old school flavour, man, like, I love you guys. And then I remember we're all right. Do you know what I mean? I'd say to my mates, like, yeah, we're all right. And he genuinely looked quite bewildered.
Yeah,
it wasn't like a thing of like
you weren't inselling yourself.
Like I wasn't like, damn right, we're if you couldn't find anyone better.
But if you think about it, they reckon that you've got about 60,000 to 80,000 thoughts a day. That's how many thoughts we tend to produce a day. And some of the research out there would say that about 70-80% are negative in content.
Don't say that.
It's automated. Well, it's automated. And the problem is that a lot of people don't realise that. And yeah, all the stuff, media, TV, press, magazines, all of this stuff. But I think this is kind of largely what I talk about, is that the importance of how you segregate.
Remove
yourself from not buying into the stuff.
They're not your voices sometimes,
yeah, exactly. Well, they're learned. Most of it's inherited. You know? Most of my critical voices I learned from growing up. Do you know what I mean? They're not my stuff.
100%.
You're given it. Do you know what
ideas
I mean?
Of what you should be rather than how you are.
Yeah, or how you should think or how you should react or behave and stuff. So growing up teaches you that. I think that's the one thing I'm really enjoying about getting older, is that you become much freer because you start to let go of a lot of the kind of the old stuff. And I'm kind of really enjoying that as I get older, that I'm kind of less
that's officially the fourth time I've heard that with every decade. Actually genuinely gets better.
Oh, you free up a bit. Definitely.
I know, everyone was like, I heard someone on the train going, mate, trust me, your 50s better than your 40s.
Yeah.
And your 40s, damn sight better than my 30s. And my 30s was 100% better than my 20s.
That's true, actually.
And I was just there as a 27-year-old, like, sweet. I mean, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, something to look forward to.
I reckon my 20s were better than my teens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Think I'm in love with a singer, but I want to get richer. Life threw me a bag of lemons, no wonder I'm bitter.
NHS.
Yeah.
Just out of interest, this is obviously something that we're very passionate about with I'm Whole. Mm-hmm. We want to try and make some headway in there being more of an emphasis around the importance of mental health.
Yeah.
I'd say in all divisions. The other night, unfortunately, my girlfriend was very ill. We went to A&E, and this person had a psychotic episode. Well, that's what I'd describe. And the response was so interesting, you know. I felt it was like, it wasn't like they turned to their team, you know, they're understaffed already, but they didn't turn to the team and go, oh, let go and get whoever, and they can come in and work. It was literally, they got security, threw them out.
Okay.
And I was like, and I thought like, oh man, it'd be so, I wonder if there would ever be a world where there is an instant understanding of the difference between.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, somebody who is having the genuine episode and somebody
who's a threat,
who might be a bit drunk. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think we're in a better position than we were 5-10 years ago. I think, you know, people like yourself here talking about mental health, lots of celebrities talking about mental health, the NHS are working very, you know, I think, to be fair, the NHS are working hard to keep mental health on the agenda and to push really hard. I think they do some brilliant work. I think I would be lying, and I think anybody would be lying, is, you know, of course we need to keep working harder, and of course we need to find more resources. But it's tricky, because for years mental health wasn't talked about. You know, it was kept away, and people didn't, you know, you're talking about psychosis, which is on the more extreme end, but people didn't talk about anxiety, they didn't talk about depression, you know, they weren't named.
Do you think people would be more engaged generally if there was more clarity around mental health actually also being physical health? Because I feel a bit bizarre about that separation.
Well, it's a bit like if you've got a cold or a flu or something, you probably wouldn't think twice about going to your doctor or getting help. You just wouldn't. Whereas actually, if you're feeling a bit depressed or a bit anxious or
physical
obsession, well, of course it is. They all overlap. You know, you can't differentiate between physical and mental health. They all impact on each other. But the problem is, I think stigma wise, people for a long time thought if you struggle with any mental health issues, that it's about weakness and people worry about losing control and all of that stuff. Where actually, you know, look, the 1 in 4 statistic, I argue that's probably underestimated. And everybody, I mean, I'm not even a huge fan of diagnosis, because I think we can all waver on trajectories. You know, you might have a week when you're a bit more anxious than normal, or you might have a week when you're a bit low. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're clinically depressed, but I think we're all on a trajectory.
Yeah, I do think that needs to be
times, and we need to normalize it a bit more.
That does need to be, there's always, whenever these pendulums swing, there are always extremes, and I do think that there is a potential for there to be a lack of motivation on a basis you can just label yourself and then the work's done.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, whereas actually it should be seen as a real great moment for, you know, the other thing I really want to try and get across with the campaigning is that I believe the pain you experience in these scenarios, anxiety, depression, I believe anyway, and there is research to back it up, it's all rooted in something. It's rooted in wiring that occur at a very young age. But I think giving yourself space to actually feel what it is, that the trauma that's trapped, actually breeds a whole world of more motivational energy the other side of it.
I think you've hit a really important point. One of the chapters in 10 to Zen is called The Antics of the Brain.
Yeah.
And it's really helping people in a really clear-cut way understand their brain. Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that goes on there sometimes can feel really abnormal for a lot of people. They don't understand what's happening. They don't understand the pathways and why they might be responding and reacting. And I think it's like any piece of equipment, it's a bit like the microphone falling earlier.
Yeah.
Once you know how to fix it, you've got a technique for sorting it out.
Yeah.
You'll do it. And I think often with kind of mental health issues, people don't understand the mechanism of the mind. And I think that's one of the things that I felt was really important. And a really simplistic way to explain, like, when you're struggling, this is likely what's happening. This is probably what's going on in your mind. So the book really is done in 3 stages about helping people, firstly, kind of deactivate that threat system in the mind. So you've got a part of your brain.
I've just listened to something on this.
And the amygdala. So it's on the right-hand side of the brain. And when it's activated, it's helpful if you need to get out of a room quickly, which is great. But if your threat system's activated all the time in everyday life, then it just means you've got all these chemicals going through your constantly body that you don't need. So you're going to feel wired and you're going to feel stressed and all of that stuff. So in the book, what I teach people in the first section of the book is how to slow stuff down.
Yeah.
How to almost deactivate quickly that threat center so that they're not in this heightened state the whole time.
Yeah.
And then the book then moves on to once you've done that and brought things down a few notches, it then teaches people how to manage your thoughts and the content of their mind, all the stuff that you were talking about earlier. Because once you learn how to manage it and take it less seriously, then things become a bit easier.
Totally.
That's my experience.
Yeah, you've got to get the toolkit.
Yeah.
The toolkit to get through life. And you know, the emphasis as well is these books are necessary now because as a human race, we are advancing incredibly quickly. More, I think, a little faster than our evolutionary brains and bodies can keep up with. So I think it's really important. This is, you know, this part of a necessary understanding at this point. I think mindfulness, we're moving towards mindfulness because it's unavoidable at the pace we're working.
Yeah, of course. You know, most people are.
Did you do a 10-minute practice because it rhymed with Zen? Or did
No, I'll tell you how that came about.
11, heaven to
11? I was teaching it loads. I'd go into big organisations and I would teach them stress management and mindfulness. That was the second book. Take a note. What made me do that was when I was teaching it, you'd go into these big corporate organisations. It used to make me laugh, actually, and they would be forced to come.
Oh, really?
And you'd get there and there'd be like 20, 30 people in the room in their suits and their arms would be folded and they'd be really pissed so off tired. That their manager had made them come to this day. And I would arrive and they wouldn't know what to expect. You know, say this guy's coming to talk about mental health and mindfulness, and you'd get there and they'd be really, really not engaged, certainly for the first 5-10 minutes. But then, interestingly, once you get into it and you made it relevant to them, so I would always start the day by saying, has anyone ever woken up feeling demotivated? Has anyone ever woke up just thinking they can't be bothered? Has anyone ever woke up thinking they've got so many worries on their mind they don't know where to start? Yeah. So when you start asking these questions, it's quite funny. It's like a Christmas tree. You'd almost see like lights in the room because you would start to spot who you targeted. And then certainly by about the end of 10 questions, you'd kind of everyone in the room hooked. So I'd say, look, if even one thing I've said has resonated, then you're probably in the right course. So then people would, and then by the end of the day, they would be lining up to ask questions. So when I was teaching it, one of the questions I would get all the time is about time. I've got a busy life, I've got a couple of kids, I've got a job, I don't know how I'd fit this into my day. So when I started to train it, I started teaching people techniques that were really consolidated, sharp, quick, so that they could fit it into their day. So the technique was 10 minutes a day, and I thought, well, I can't really call it 10 minutes a day. I thought about calling it Take 10. And then I thought, what am I trying to achieve? And I thought, well, I'm trying to get people to live in a more Zen-like, not in a Buddhist way, but a more kind of calmer day-to-day living. And I thought, well, what about 10 to Zen? And suddenly that seemed to resonate and people liked it. And
it's wonderful.
And it worked.
Everyone loves a rhyme.
Yeah, and it, you know.
I want to ask some questions a little bit about just, I've got these couple of questions that I ask on this podcast that are for all intents and purposes pathetic, but I love them because they're secretly revealing, I find. So I'm going to hit you with them real quick. First up, what's your favourite colour?
Red.
Oh, that was quick.
Yeah.
Why?
Don't know, actually. I don't know if we even thought about this, bizarrely, actually, but
people think there's a basic interview question, it's actually real deep.
No, I just profound. No, it's interesting because immediately I thought about the colour of a door.
A door? Red door?
Yeah, a door. But I'll tell you why. It's because every time I paint my house and stuff, my partner always, I always have this thing about I'd love a red, you know, like pillar postbox red door.
Right.
I think it's like the coolest colour in the world. And we end up always having this argument about you can't have a red door. It just looks stupid. But I do know something about that colour that I find.
Gee, and you can't think of why.
No, but it's just, I don't know, I think it's just quite an engaging, affirmative, life-giving colour.
Life-giving. Yeah. Love that.
Yeah.
Red, like deep scarlet red.
Yeah, just kind of, it says something, doesn't it? You don't forget red, do you? Well, I don't.
What's your favourite shape?
What's my favourite shape? Probably a circle.
Of course, thank you. I think the circle's winning in this. It's the circle of, you know.
Well, it's life, really. It sounds cliche, but everything's continuous. And
I am whole. You know,
we're always on this trajectory and this journey, and it's never really complete.
It's infinite, isn't it?
Yeah, we're never complete, as we want to be. I used to have this notion that, you know, I love that expression, getting it together, but actually we're never together. You know, we can be together for a day and then something else happens and, you know, it knocks us out a bit or things change. And I think learning to accept that we're never fully together and that we never fully work it out. And there's never fully an answer to everything. I think it was great freedom.
Just let go of that.
You just kind of...
When you've got Aristotle, who's one of the greatest philosophers of all time, ending his life by saying, all that I know is that I know nothing.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
It's like, well, all right.
There's a good freedom in that, though,
isn't
there?
I think I'll pretty much give up thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly.
There is, yeah. Surrender, isn't it? That's what I've been trying to do. I think there's a lot of convincing to oneself that you're trying to get somewhere.
I mean, there's a great notion about, and again, it sounds really, really cliched, but I think often the more you surrender, the more happens. You know, I think often we just put so much time and energy into trying to control outcomes, and actually the more you let go, I just think you almost allow space for things to evolve and happen.
Yeah.
I think even in my own life, I've discovered that, even around my own career and the book and different stuff, when I let go and I just don't get stressed about what's coming next or what will happen, it just evolves and it happens.
Yeah.
It takes care of itself, really.
I was wanting to ask you actually a little bit earlier, what do you think has been your best period of mental well-being? Has it kind of been...
I mean, I think you can have periods in your life. I remember years ago in my 20s, I went off to America and did work on a summer camp.
Right.
And I was working with these kids, and I play piano, so I was teaching them. I got a job as a musical director in this summer camp.
Love that.
So I was teaching these kids.
What time is this? Was this before or after A&E?
This was before.
Oh, cool.
So this was just when, in fact, it was just when I left the monastery.
Right.
And I had this kind of year.
You left the monastery and became a musical director.
No, well, I went to music school as a kid. So
I'm building the picture.
I went to the summer camp, and I applied to go as a musical director because I played piano, but I also ticked all of these boxes on the form about talents and abilities I had, as you do.
You're making sure.
And so I ticked soccer and stuff. I never played soccer in my life.
Brilliant.
And I got to this American summer camp, and they brought all these kids. You were called camp counsellors, and you were brought up onto stage. So I said, our music director's from Ireland, so I went up onto stage, talked about I was going to do a show, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So I was a musical director, and by the end of summer the kids were going to put on a production.
Love it.
So I did my bit, went and sat down again, a few other guys went up and talked about what they were going to do, and then they said, so we're going to introduce our soccer coach for the season, all the way from Ireland. So I started to look around the room thinking, oh great, there's somebody else from Ireland here. I was over in Boston, and they said, so can we get Owen back on stage again? He's our soccer coach for the summer. So I had to get up on stage for about 200 people and talk about being a soccer coach for the season. Never played soccer in my life.
Love that.
But I ticked it on my form, and that was my...
That's beautiful.
So I had to get up, and I literally, I didn't even know. So what I used to do with the kids was, I couldn't tell them, I didn't have the guts to tell them I couldn't play soccer. So what I used to do was, I used to play football with the kids, and I used to say, right, we're going to drop all the rules. So we're not going to do offside, we're not going to do anything. Because I hadn't got three. I didn't know what was offside.
Why didn't you just say?
So I had a great time.
That is hilarious. You coached a soccer team.
Soccer with no rules.
No knowledge
of
football.
Soccer with no rules, and the kids had a great time.
I mean, when I used to play football, that with no rules would lead to just pure violence.
No, it didn't. The American kids went for it. But that period was probably one of the happiest periods of my life, actually. I had a really great summer there, and I think it was something about it. It was one of my first big trips. I was working in America. I'd got a bit of time out of Ireland. I didn't feel different. There was a real openness, and there was a real freedom of spirit, and I felt like I belonged, and I kind of managed to fit in somewhere. And had a great time, really good time. That was probably my happiest period.
That sounds about that, great.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you say has been your worst period of as well?
My most difficult period was probably coming out.
Yeah.
Coming out as gay, that was a really massive thing, because I didn't I planned to come out, but I didn't, when I came out wasn't the time. So I thought I was probably going to tell my parents in like 2-3 years. So I'd come out of the monastery, realised, okay, well, I think I need to start telling somebody, but I'm not going to do it for 2-3 years. And literally, I was out of the monastery 2 days.
You planned to not say anything for 2 days.
I wasn't
going to
come. I wasn't ready. I definitely wasn't ready. But I told one person at the time, and unfortunately, they were friends of my brother's wife.
Oh God!
Which is very, very odd. And within a day, my brother contacted me and he said, "Is there something you want to tell me?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Oh, are you gay?" And I said, "Oh my God! How did you find out?" So he said, "You better tell mum and dad." He said,
"What did they say?"
They were all right, actually. I mean, it was just a classic coming out to your Irish parents. I mean, it was just, yeah, you could put this on stage. It was so well done because, you know, they went through all of this.
All the emotions.
Well, I kind of said to them, I set them down and said, I've got something to tell you. And my mum went through this list of, have you got someone pregnant?
You know, that is the classic one, isn't it, when you say that?
Yeah, are you...
Have you murdered anyone?
Yeah, are you in drugs? Are you having an affair with somebody? I mean, I just left a monastery 24 hours ago, so they were all highly unlikely possibilities, but they went through this checklist of, was I a drug dealer? Was I taking drugs? Had I got someone pregnant? I said, no, none of the above.
I love that there's a reality where you come out as a drug dealer.
Yeah.
I love that's a thing that you would get
down
your bed.
Yeah, but I was in a monastery for 3 years before it, so I mean, how any of this would have happened is beyond me.
I mean, that could be a pretty decent place to shot some drugs, man.
It could be.
You guys need to chill a bit. That's all for you.
So anyway, they went through their list, and a bizarre thing had happened the day before. There was a fire in a, I think it was a gay nightclub or something in Dublin.
Really?
Or something. There was some fire in a gay venue in Dublin. And I remember it was on telly, and my mum saying, when this headline came on about the fire in the gay place in Dublin, my mum saying, God, that's incredible. And I thought, what's she going to say? And she said, I thought all gay people lived in America. And I thought, well, she's in for a shock.
Whoa.
So the following day then, I sat them down and they did their list. And
all gay people live in America.
Well, that was my mum's thought at the time. God, I thought most gay
That's
people.
That's amazing.
So then I told them, so they did their checklist. And at the end, I said, my mum then said, interestingly, she said, everything else, are you? And then the last one, she said, you're not gay, are you? And I said, actually, I am.
That's the last one.
And then my dad then said, oh, don't be silly. That's a phase, you know. They got their head around it eventually. And, you know, it really made me think, actually, because it took me a long time coming to grips with it. So it actually would have been wrong for me to expect them to...
But quite seriously, though, for that to be considered your worst period of mental well-being, were those 2 years almost debilitating in terms of the repression?
I think it was about fear. For me, it was largely about fear and anxiety, really, because coming out, well, I talk about shame a lot. There's a chapter
underpins everything.
I think I do, and I think I deliberately had a chapter in shame because I think shame underpins everything.
Yeah.
Not good enough, not lovable, not worthy. All of this stuff goes on in a lot of people's narrative. And for me, it did around, you know, being gay. It was about, am I good enough? Am I a bad person? All of that rubbish that, you know, that went through my head at the time. My biggest fear was that if I come out...
But it might have...
Will people reject me?
That was a
big possibility. Yeah. Will they reject me? And
if they do,
how will I manage that? So that was a big period for me. And plus, I hadn't quite worked out in my head, well, am I bad? You know, you're a Catholic, I'm a Catholic, but as a Catholic, there was a big question mark around that. Well, if you do this, you go to hell.
Really?
And I kind of believed that, believed that stuff in my late teens.
Yeah, this is wild like that.
So that was kind of, you know, there was enough material there to make that period very, very difficult. But then when I did come out, it was interesting. I mean, I talk a lot about openness and honesty and truth-telling. When I was truthful about it, just immediately I just felt relief.
Yeah,
because there was nothing to hide anymore. Yeah. And then when I started to see people respond positively and warmly and not rejecting, then I started to build up enough evidence that it was all in my head.
Yeah.
Because all these horror stories I told myself didn't... No one rejected me, ultimately. No one told me I was bad. So for me, it's always about...
I'm quite lucky.
Just talk to people. Just whatever you're struggling with, you know, don't hold it back. Get it out there. Tell your truth, you know.
Yeah,
because it's not that scary. It's more scary in our heads than it is when we tell it.
Yeah, I'm a true believer in honesty. I think that's the true way to living in your truth is the way to go.
It is. It's a way to go.
But I will say that as I'd like to say ascend into adulthood, one thing that has been very frustrating is I feel in some cases you're actually punished for honesty, and I think this leads to a kind of space where people develop that fear from experience rather than from a projected experience.
There's a great expression, and I think it's really, really true, that if you're honest and you shine light on something, you always get a shadow. You know, light always comes with shadow, and if you're truthful about stuff or you shine light on stuff, there'll always be a price tag with it. But I think sometimes you've got to be really brave. I mean, sometimes I have to make decisions or I have to have conversations with people that are not easy. Mm-hmm. And there's always a bit of a risk with it. But actually, you know, it always, in the end, the outcome's always favourable. But I think you always have this period in the middle. You know, most people don't like, most people struggle with honesty.
Yeah.
You know, or telling stuff as it is. Because, you know, we're all very respectable, aren't we? And we kind of give different versions of ourselves. But sometimes when we are honest, it's more difficult. But, you know, it rarely goes wrong.
What would you say as I mean, I know it's different. When I ask this question to most people, they haven't written a book on calming yourself down. But what would you... Yeah, you've just answered it, really. I was going to ask what kind of advice you'd offer to a young person going through the phases and their these kind of stages of understanding themselves, you know. Like one simple piece of advice, other than buy a book.
Rather than buy the book. I'm not going to do a hard plug in the book. I think for young people and particularly struggling, I mean, the statistics for young people is you know, it's scary. And I do think, you know, with things as they are at the minute, with kind of social media, press, TV, you know, Brexit, you know, everywhere is uncertainty. If you look at a textbook definition of anxiety, it's an intolerance of uncertainty.
Mm.
So it's really difficult not to be anxious because we've got uncertainty everywhere. You know, there's a lot. So that's the kind of external stuff. We live in a world where there's a load of, you know, difficult stuff going on and a lot of uncertainty. And managing that is difficult, but it is doable. But I think the bigger battles go on internally. And I think most of that is about when you don't kind of walk comfortably in your own shoes in life.
Mm.
So when you kind of start to be what you think other people want you to be, or you start living your life based on other people's values or their truths, whatever, it's just a really uncomfortable way to live. It's like wearing a pair of shoes that don't fit you properly. It's just not a good way to go through your day. And I think, you know, it's about living, you know, it's about living your life in a way that's right for you, accepting yourself, whatever that is, you know, because, you know, everyone, I don't know anybody who doesn't carry stuff that they're not comfortable with.
Mm.
Every human being struggling with something. And I think learning to just accept that. And rather than see difference, this is particularly for people who do see themselves as different in any way, regardless whether that be colour, sexuality, race, religion, it doesn't matter. Your difference doesn't have to, you know, your difference can enrich your life. It doesn't have to be a negative influence in your life. It doesn't have to define who you are. And I think a lot of people don't see that with difference. They often play it out a different way. You know, they become almost victimized by it rather than see it as something worth celebrating. It took me a long time to learn that. It was kind of well into my early 30s before I learned that actually my difference set me apart and it was worth celebrating. It wasn't something I had to be ashamed of. When I was in my early 20s, they had a gay pride in Belfast and there was about 50 people at it. Now there's about 40, 50,000 people go to it. And that was only 20 years ago. But I watched it from a side street, you know, in Belfast, because I was terrified that I would be spotted. Terrified. But I was terrified that I'd be spotted as different.
Being blendy ain't trendy.
Absolutely. You probably said that a lot better than I ever would have, but yeah, sounds much better coming from you.
Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast.
Likewise.
Mate.
Thank you.
It is always good to have a professional. You know what the best thing is though, having you come on from the space of having written the book, but actually finding out the reasons as to why you know, the journey that's led you to this point. And
thank you.
An advocate of truth on the Whole Truth podcast. Bad boy. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Love.
Thank you.
You're right, everyone. Really appreciate you listening. So make sure that you subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Acast.
Hold up. What was that?
Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Powered by Spirit Studios.